Peace Talks, a series of programs investigating how we can make peace and pursue nonviolent solutions to conflict within ourselves, our families, our communities, and our world. Author and psychotherapist Harriet Lerner writes, "Whether we're speaking of warring couples or nations, it's an extraordinary challenge to move from blaming people toward understanding patterns and our own part in them. It's a similarly huge challenge that our wish to understand the other party be as great as our wish to be understood." Today on Peace Talks, Nonviolent Communication.
I'm Suzanne Kreider. When you hear the term communication technology, what do you think of? Fax machines? Cell phones? Maybe email? Today on Peace Talks, we'll learn about nonviolent communication, a verbal technology for exchanging information and resolving differences peacefully. We're going to begin by talking with Jorge Rubio, a trainer in nonviolent communication, about how this communication approach helps to resolve conflict. Then later in the program, we're going to ask him to help some members of our studio audience develop solutions to conflict scenarios using these principles of nonviolent communication. Welcome, Jorge.
Thank you very much, Suzanne.
This term nonviolent communication, it makes me wonder, does that mean that all the rest of our communication is violent?
The short answer to that is yes. I think that most of the thinking behind our habitual ways of communicate and the actions that we take on the basis of that communication are violent. But I want to define that very carefully. When I say that that's violent, is that it's not communication efforts that actually lead to cooperation, mutual respect, and understanding. There's a certain form of thinking that we call domination thinking, and it's so deeply ingrained that it actually dominates political speech, it dominates family interactions, it dominates community exchanges of any sort.
What is domination thinking?
It's a certain thinking that divides the world in a moralistic way. There's good people and bad people, and there is the issue of should, you shouldn't have done it. Judgments are the main way to evaluate others. And there's the concept of deserve and punishment. So whenever all those things come together, it's very unlikely that community sustainability and a real engagement where interdependence naturally occurs will not happen.
Yeah, but shouldn't there be morals? Shouldn't there be shoulds?
Well, I think that when we focus on evaluating through morals and shoulds, we have sort of a blowback event. I think that we are better served evaluating on the basis of human needs. By trying to present our plight to somebody using moralistic judgments, we actually sabotage the possibility that that person will hear us. I'd rather that we bring up to this person what we observe the person did, how we feel about that, what need of ours was not met or met with their actions, and what we're requesting from them to do right now. If we actually do that, then we initiate a sort of a dance of connection that creates the possibility of everybody's needs being met.
So I want to go back to those four pieces you mentioned, but let's start with needs. That was the third piece you mentioned.
Yes.
How is a need different than a moral or a should?
Well, as we use needs, we really try to refer to them as the living energy in a human's heart. So needs are universal values in any human's heart. When I am able to distill my message to just express to you what is that need of mine, either it is understanding or connection or respect that was not met, it will be easy for you to connect with that need. Conversely, when you're speaking and in the moment you're not having the resources to express your needs clearly and you are in a moment of anger, I hope I can have the ability to translate your message into the underlying needs. See, needs underlying any human action and any human word. And if I'm able to focus on that, then I create what we call empathic connection. And if I create empathic connection, then I am in a world of possibilities where without anybody having to submit or to rebel, we can meet everybody's needs.
All right, let's go through the four steps. Let's go through each one, and can you give us an example, maybe using a scenario?
Yes, for example, if I lend a book to somebody and he returns it with drawings and little poems on the side of the pages.
I hate that.
Yes, I have two ways of expressing that. Why would you tell that person in a few choice words? What would be a way to express irritation in habitual communication? We could judge the person. It's wrong to have done that. What were you thinking? How can you be so disrespectful or irresponsible? So that would be one way of evaluating the situation. When I try to come from a different consciousness, I would simply first express my observation and try to make clear that I am not using any interpretative language in it. So when I see you returning the book with drawings and poems or writings in its pages.
Okay, so that's the first component.
Neutral, non-evaluative observation. The second component puts us in dire straits because culturally we are actually disconnected from the feelings. Most of the feelings that we use due to our cultural conditioning are actually accusations or judgments. People use words like, I feel attacked, I feel ignored, I feel abused. Those are not what we call feelings. So we want to really support communities and individuals to relearn the vibrant language of feelings. So when I see you return the book in this way, I feel angry and frustrated. And then immediately I connect my feelings with my own needs. This is sort of the quantum leap of nonviolent communication. Instead of connecting what I'm feeling with you as a cause, I connect my feelings with the actual source of my feelings, which is either my met or unmet need. In this case, the need not met would be a certain need for respect or consideration of my property. So I want to relearn the ability to clearly transmit to you my experience without any perception of you having done wrong or deserving punishment for what you have done. If I'm coming in any way with those elements included in my communication, it's unlikely that I will create with you a quality of understanding and connection.
So those are the four steps.
Yes.
Observation, yeah. Feeling, need.
And request.
Request.
Yes.
Which step do people find the most difficult to learn?
I think we're in trouble for all of them. Because first, we don't know how to observe without evaluating. Most of what we believe is an observation is actually an evaluation. When I saw you being so unkind to me yesterday, is a way that people would describe a situation. It's very subjective. I don't know what you mean by unkind, or kind for that matter. Feelings, we're deeply disconnected from our feelings. Our need literacy is extremely low. People don't really connect at that level with themselves. And then we don't know how to do requests. We're very well trained in doing demands from people. So they're all of them need a lot of development and practice. But it's a sort of practice not trying to learn NVC. I'm not interested in all of having a group of people talking strange language and using four steps at all times. The power that I see in this work, at least what attracted me to it, is that I really see addressing something that seems like a more natural way of communicating with each other. When I'm only coming from blame, accusation, and moralistic judgments, I've never been able to create the sort of understanding and connection that I like.
This is Peace Talks. We're talking with Jorge Rubio, a trainer in nonviolent communication, about how this communication style helps to resolve conflict. The creator of nonviolent communication, Marshall Rosenberg, has written a book titled Nonviolent Communication. There are many astounding stories in the book, but there's one that comes to mind for me around this. And it's the story of a woman who was in a training. She was in a situation where a man attacked her, I believe with a knife. Is that true?
She was, by some confusion in scheduling, she had been left alone in the hostel for people with drug addictions in Canada. So she was there and this man came in sort of really in an intense state, to say it in that way. And he screamed, I want a bed. And she just said, sorry, sir, there is no beds. And I think she looked down to write the address of the other hostel so he could go there. And the next thing she knew, he had jumped over the table, put her down on the floor, straddled her, put a knife to her throat, and screamed to her, don't lie to me, there is a bed, and some other more choice language. And at that moment, she remembered a joke. And the joke is, it's sort of a joke within the system. We use certain visual reminders of these. But we caution people in terms of not using "but" in front of somebody who is angry. Never put your "but" in front of an angry person. B-U-T. That is a play of words, and I'm over-explaining it, of course. But the point is that if somebody's angry and you're going to give them explanations, you're only going to escalate the situation. So she stopped herself because that was her first reaction, to explain to him, to advocate for her the truthfulness of her original message. She stopped, and she said, well, I'll try that thing, that NVC thing, which she had learned a week before or so. And we use the following language for empathy. Are you feeling because you have a need? So she just guessed. Sir, are you feeling really angry because you're really wanting people to tell you the truth? I might. And he responds, I still in on her chest and with a knife on her throat. I might be living in the streets. I might not have anything to fall on, but I'm still a human being. You want me to understand that regardless of your circumstances, you want to be respected as a human being. You're right. And we asked her, Marshall asked her later, if she hadn't been terrified about this. And she said no. Then from the moment that she started connecting, even in that precarious, it's hardly a conversation posture, but even in that position, she immediately started seeing the human being. And a few minutes later, he just relented, or she requested him to move over. And he sent him on to the other hostel after explaining the people there that he was coming and to be aware of his condition. Now, if she had used the "but" in that moment, she says that most likely he would not be telling the tale. So that's the power of empathy in those difficult situations. It allows us to see anger and rage not as the acts of an evil person, but as a huge opportunity for compassion. This human being is at a loss of resources and is trying in the best way he knows how to call attention to a need that is so unmet and about which he's so hopeless to meet that he does the best he can to call attention to that. And if we take the ride, it always leads to a de-escalation.
I'd like to get some real-world application of the four components. And we've got some folks in our studio audience. If there's someone who'd be willing to share a conflict situation or scenario, if you could step up to the mic.
Hi, my question has to do with how your teachings apply at the community level. And let's say, for instance, that a neighborhood is having a problem because there's a lot of cars driving too fast, and they would like the city to put up a stop sign. And they have tried going to the city and speaking their needs and being reasonable, and they've been ignored. And what they find is that if they act very angry and maybe picket or raise their voices in different ways, that they will get results that way. Hmm. So how would you respond to that type of situation?
Well, my main concern is I would like the community to be able to be as creative as it is necessary. But I believe anger and dehumanization of those whose acts we do not enjoy actually disempower us. We lose resources in that very energy-intensive process of hating and getting angrier and angrier. I would like us to do our rage work. If you and I were in that community, one part of the meetings would be trying to clarify what are our needs, because the needs there are not met by not getting the response we wanted. If we really do that, then we would have even more resources. Our power of convincing, and also one crucial part of this, which is trying to connect respectfully with resistance to our wishes. So we want to understand what is preventing the council or the city council to respond to our requests. So the issue is power of connection and how I experience getting angry and staying angry and coming for the trying to get my needs met from anger as a very, very dangerous allocation of resources, because it takes the energy from that place of creating mutual respect under difficult circumstances. In the larger scale in the world, a lot of what's happening is really deaf sides talking to each other, where all we see is an escalation of more and more violence. We want to create the possibility of receiving even very difficult actions against our community and being able to sprout to action without forgetting the humanness of those whose actions we do not enjoy. I don't believe the contagious or infectious quality of the of violence will change in this world until we can do our respond to violence in a way that doesn't replicate it with them.
Yes, go ahead.
I'm wondering if this is really realistic, whether human beings have the capability of nonviolent communication. Because in my mind, we're rational animals, and we tend to forget the animal part. And I was thinking while you were speaking of the situation I had at home, that my neighbor's dogs killed a cat. And I was on one side of the fence, hysterical, trying to save the cat. And on the other side of the fence were the dogs doing dog things, right? This is the way dogs in a pack behave. Mm. And so I'm wondering if we're forgetting that animal part of our humanity that is the predator, that is capable of that violence, and that when we look at our history as human beings, it's been there forever.
See, I've come after these years of work with nonviolent communication and how people have reported to me from their lives, to really believe that if we create genuine understanding and if we're really able to start creating systems based on respect and mutuality and requests and not demands, so there's no coercion and deep respect for each other, I'm hard-pressed to find any human being remaining in that gang pack behavior that you're describing. I believe that that is only possible as a reaction to a pre-existing inhuman system. And that's when people end up behaving like that. When I have seen people approach me in very difficult ways, I've found that a moment of deep listening will transform what seemed this animal predatory attack. Human needs, for example, there is no need to have revenge. There is no need to punish. Those are, as I experience them, more cultural inventions. 10,000 years ago, in the advent of agriculture, this thing was invented to think on the basis of moralistic judgments. Who's wrong? Who deserves to suffer? And who am I going to punish? Which is the pack behavior, at least is how I hear it. So I don't have an experience that anybody from any walk of life stays in the tragic path when they are received with deep, respectful understanding and when they can actually trust that we're equally interested in meeting their needs as much as we are in meeting our needs.
Do we have any other questions or comments, scenarios?
I seem to have trouble when people kind of give me unsolicited advice.
Yes.
And especially out of the blue, like I didn't even ask. You know, well, I guess that's what unsolicited advice is. But, you know, just like, whoa. Or, you know, you need one of these.
Yes.
And
yes.
That's, you know, it's not as violent of a reaction. But I've actually reacted pretty violently
yes.
to that.
Well, and I'm very happy to know that you do, because it immediately tells me that I am talking to a human being. You have a profound need for autonomy and freedom. And you really do not enjoy getting education when people have not asked permission from you and when they have not addressed education in a way that would be useful or valuable to you. Most of human care, how people care for each other in this world, is expressed through education. And education before empathic connection usually stimulates what you just reported that you experience, resistance and disgust, we immediately go into protecting our autonomy. I don't want you to be the judge of what I'm supposed to need. I would like you to ask my permission if I want to hear more education. So sometimes in the workshops, people get one thing that really changes their life, and it's those two components. Before you want to educate somebody, respectfully connect with that person and ask them permission. Hey, when I hear you saying that you have a cold, I've used certain things lately that were useful to me. Would you like to hear about them? Oh, what a relief to give them a yes or a no before you blast them. In some contexts, you cannot sniffle because suddenly within, you know, the next 2 minutes, you will have all the herbs and all the homeopathy and all the exercises that are supposed to help with sniffling. And it does not sink in. So the giver of the education is trying to meet a need for support of others, for contribution, and she doesn't get it met. And the receiver of education ends up in a quandary because they sort of see the care, but at the same time, it doesn't feel like something you want to receive.
How would you use the four components if you were the receiver of some unrequested advice?
Well, it's tricky because I would be so angry that I first have to attend to that. So I give myself self-empathy. So I close my mouth, notice that I am really up on arms, and then I go into, God, I feel so enraged when people presume to know what is good for me. I feel the emotion, and then I stumble into, oh, I'm feeling really angry because I have a need for autonomy. When you connect with the need, notice it's not just to recite it or to understand it, but you connect with the need, then there's a shift. It's a perceptible shift from the domination thinking to connection. Now and once I connect with my unmet need for autonomy, suddenly I become curious as to what were the beautiful needs this human being was trying to meet by offering unsolicited advice. Oh, and now I'm very moved. And I would just, that would be the first step. Once I've empathized with my need for autonomy, then I shift to be able to have the resources to understand what was the origin of the actions that I didn't enjoy. So I guess when you saw me sniffling, you felt really concerned and offered something that you thought could be useful for me. The person says, yes, thank you, that was my intention. And then I shift now to sharing with them how I would like to receive their gifts if they have them. So I shift to myself again and I say, you know, I'm very touched to hear that, but it was hard for me to receive it. And I wonder if you want to hear how I would suggest that you offer those things to me when you are experiencing a desire to contribute. So again, I ask permission because now I want to educate. But notice I'm educating after I ask permission. And then I would tell them, when you have any ideas of wanting to contribute to my well-being, it would make it easier for me to receive it if you ask me if I want to hear it. So there's a whole loop there. And notice, if we just stay in the reaction, which is that you get angry and express the anger, the person ends up hurt because they wanted to contribute, and you end up also disconnected. So it fosters disconnection. As you probably notice there, it's a real dance between honesty and listening, expression and listening, and we have lost our ability to do what is the natural art of engaging through communication and presence.
How do you help people deal with anger? Anger is such a powerful force. Yeah. And, for example, I was trying to use NVC with my husband last night, and when he didn't respond exactly how I wanted him to be, I screamed at him. So, you know, A for effort, F for empathy here.
Yes.
What do we do with this anger?
Well, anger is a sort of a pet project of mine since it seems to be my default emotion. So anger is truly presents quite a challenge. To express your anger, to go and use words and actions to try to express your anger is always an incomplete expression of that anger. For many of us, the illusion, the terrible illusion, is that when we have anger, we think we're very powerful. Men are particularly shortchanged in this regard because they think adrenaline equals power. I want to say that you are actually the most vulnerable in those moments. You don't know what you want. You're using energy in a way that that person is not even hearing what you say, but trying to defend or counterattack. So you're really tragically using energy in a way that gets you farther and farther away from getting your needs met. So nonviolent communication helps us slow down the process enough so that we can do three things. First, detect that we are angry and therefore disconnected. Second, really engage with it. Really feel what is that's going on inside me right now that I feel this rage. And if you do that, you stumble into your feelings and needs. That is the diagram of the process of empathy, whether it is empathy that other people give you, which is just simply presence and understanding, or the more finer or difficult art of self-empathy. So right now, going to last night, when your husband was not able to connect with your efforts of connection, he wasn't really getting what you wanted him to get, this is how the self-empathy might have sounded. First, you notice that you're angry, so your breathing tells you, you feel hot in the face, whatever the signs for yourself are of anger. And then you go into the judgments that you might have of him. Of course, we hoped you do this with your mouth closed. It does not help to get expressive at this stage. I just can't believe it. I mean, why can't he understand? I'm trying really hard to connect with him. I'm feeling frustrated and angry because I have a need for understanding. So that's the third step. Suddenly, it's not like you have to kickstart your feelings and needs. You discover them. They're always there. So once we get to the feelings and the needs, you are empowered again. Nonviolent communication is about really creating a model of a new definition of power in presence and communication.
We're coming to the end of our program. Jorge, would you recommend a few books, websites, or other resources that our listeners might look to for some more help on this topic?
Yes, thank you. First, I want to mention that in the month of August and partly September, and then in October and November, we will be having some workshops in the area. If you're interested in coming to these workshops, please call 982-8362. You can also email us at NVC, as in nonviolent communication, NVC@cybermesa.com. There is also the website for the Center for Nonviolent Communication, which is www.cnvc.org.
And Marshall Rosenberg's book is in bookstores, too.
Yes, you can find that book in bookstores. It's called Nonviolent Communication, A Language of Compassion by Marshall Rosenberg.
We'll list those as well as have other materials, links, and even excerpts from this program on our website, which is peacetalksradio.com. That's peacetalksradio, written as one word, .com. Also at our site, you can send us your comments, sign up to be in our studio audience, or find information about ordering CD copies of our programs. That's all at peacetalksradio.com. I'd like to thank Jorge Rubio, certified trainer in nonviolent communication, for being our guest today.
Thank you, Susanne. It was really a pleasure.
Peace Talks is a production of Good Radio Shows, Incorporated, and was recorded in the studios of KUNM in Albuquerque. Producer and engineer is Paul Ingalls. Music by Ali Adelman. I'm Suzanne Kreider. Thanks for listening.
Discussion.
Any human message, verbal or nonverbal, has all these four components. There is always somebody who's observing something, who's feeling something about the observation. A need underneath is triggering or eliciting that or creating that feeling, and people always want something.
Would it be possible to use the components in a different order? What you're saying is it's not really important to structure it like a really rigid formula.
It's tricky. Once people start connecting with this sort of awareness, it's really a place where people arrive, where you were seeing the other person as an enemy, and suddenly you are suddenly interested in the welfare of everybody in the situation, Once you start connecting with that, then you end up talking street NVC. So you're just not really paying such attention to the structure, but you end up finding yourself using words for the service of connection. Now, having said that, I find a certain power and elegance in the ability to separate observation, to express the feeling, and then immediately connect it to the need. That's probably the crucial element here, that I say, I feel because I have a need. I connect my feelings with my needs. So in that part, we really emphasize and insist on that clarification. Conversely, if I'm listening to a message that is incoming, I like to be able to connect your feelings with your needs. So if somebody comes and says, this is the last time I schedule meetings with you, then I would guess, are you really feeling frustrated because you really have a need to have your time respected? So that's the way that we approach that. And I think it's a profound transformation from the sort of fairy tale that I have had all my life, where I always told people, thought people had the power to make me happy or miserable. And I thought of myself as a sort of deity, too, that had that power. And it's been quite a discovery for me to see that my feelings don't depend directly from the external stimulus, but they come from my met or unmet need.
Jorge, you've done training all over the world. Tell us a story about the most amazing use of nonviolent communication.
Well, several things come to mind. I'm very touched working with communities that I was personally not very connected with. I worked for a long time, well, for 2 years, intensively with Colombian police. And I was very impressed by the, I guess I realized how I myself was very much having a strong enemy image from them. And they taught me a lot. They really was able to see how my own way of looking at them was preventing me from connecting respectfully and effectively with them. So that's one of the things that I've been particularly touched to see, the humanness on these police personnel that most of the trainings occurred in stations that were police stations that were military objectives for during in the civil war in Colombia. So it's been very much an education for me to see that if I am dehumanizing others with whom I might disagree in what they're doing in the world, I become part of the problem. In that capacity, violence is contagious. It actually makes me believe myself in a higher moral ground, but I'm actually using the same that I'm accusing them of using. More specifically, I'm thinking of Farid as I am the director of the Latin American project, and we have a school project in a public school in Colombia, in Ibagué, in the state departamento of Tolima. And Farid was described as the terror of the school by the teachers as I came to the place. He recently had beaten a boy unconscious, and teachers to the last one really were both terrified and at a loss as to how to deal with Farid. And after the first presentation, we did presentations for most of the 3,500 students, and I'm returning there in the next months. And he sat very quietly through the presentation. And I don't like education. I like really to share sort of my passion about something, but it's not about transmitting information. And for whatever reasons, he was very touched by these possibilities of communicating what was alive in you in ways that were potentially capable of creating connection and not just more and more disconnection. So he approached me with tears in his eyes and he said, Jorge, I really need you to help me. I feel these angers in me and I really need to find a way to express that. Well, he self-selected as a nonviolent communication student leader and spent several days with me and the other group of student leaders. And at the end of that, Farid was absolutely transformed. The teachers couldn't believe it. And in the final session where we brought teachers and students together, Farid he stood up and turned to the teachers and said sort of a regret, expressed his regret about how he had behaved. But the next part is what I found particularly moving. He offered the teachers empathic listening if they were to need it. So here is what somebody perceived as a bully who receives very little attention, I mean just a few days of work, and he himself found very different resources. The teachers didn't know what to do of the situation. They were surprised, but it was a deeply authentic moment. Of course, I don't want to paint pies in the sky. To do a cultural transformation from a school system based in domination into a school system based into this sort of awareness is quite a tall order. And of course, it's been touch and go. And I continue supporting this school, the INEM school in Ibagué. But it's a long-term project.
What do you think was the transformation piece or motivator for him? There must have been a sense of readiness in him.
Well, we're all desperate for being treated with respect and deep understanding. I don't think anybody that grows up in a system that does not give ample opportunities for deep understanding of the person and that bosses people around, all we're going to get out of that is very hurt human beings that will tragically try to get their needs met. That's our definition of violence. We believe violence is a tragic attempt to meet beautiful human needs. So when you end up as angry and frustrated and hopeless that anybody cares, you're likely to behave in ways that will put you farther away from getting the understanding. That's why it's a tragic attempt. If Farid kicks the other kids around and screams insults to the teachers, it's unlikely he's going to get more understanding and connection that he's so desperate for.
I can see NVC working one-on-one in situations like that. But the problem I have is how can this happen on a cultural change, on a social level? It seems like a huge shift.
Well, that's pretty much responsible both for the loss of the hair and the increasing white coloration of my hair, because I have very little patience to dedicate whatever life I have to another personal growth process. I think the bigger challenge is what you're mentioning. I would like to see systems, genuine systems, education system, political systems, economic systems that are genuinely based on a need fulfillment approach that is non-coercive. And of course, as far as I see, we're really not as skillful in that as I would like. Now, it's sort of a chicken and the egg for me. How can we teach people an art that is not easy to learn, that is also unteachable? I cannot teach people about interdependence. Once I stop bossing them around and I listen to them deeply, they behave like profoundly intelligent, interdependent beings. So how can I support in people to rediscover that way of doing things when it's so countercultural to what's occurring in the world? And how can those people come together creatively and give birth to systems where we could actually see people conscious of the needs of others as they are of their own?
Well, let's oversimplify it. What are three steps a school system or an organization or a community could take?
Again, you know, I'm really genuinely in an experimental phase with all these. I am, for example, with schools and organizations, my biggest concern is when NVCs learn technically, like another tool to use on people, and not really understanding the clear challenge of seeing how you would, in a second, react with domination. So for now, my approach to this is within the next 3 years, I would like to have only two or three projects. And I want to live there and be doing just two or three community projects and do 5 years doing that work, because I am in this belief that unless it's a sustainable, supported, long-term effort, that all of these attempts will just not take.
Do we have any other questions or comments, scenarios?
I was talking about this with somebody today about this show, and they were talking about they had problems when people told them how they should feel or they shouldn't feel that way, you know. Okay. That was kind of that was her take on this whole thing. And I thought that was kind of along those same lines.
Again, another of the most profound aspects that we address with NVC. I think most of the violence, most of the violence occurs with yourself. And a lot of the violence occurs when people are trying to be or to feel something different than what they're already feeling. We are very averse to really feel what we're feeling. And unless we do that, we cannot fully connect with that. So when we hear others trying to tell us, don't feel so angry, it usually just increases the anger because we already need understanding. And what do we get? Education. We get somebody telling us not to be in a state that we already are. So it's almost like we don't have the right to feel what we're feeling. So with empathic listening, we teach the very different strategy, which is we want to learn to demystify all different gradients of human emotion. People are so phobic to anger, for example. I like us all to work into an environment where we can hear with compassion when somebody goes there. And also internally, I like us to be more skillful with receiving whatever it is that we are sensing coming alive in us, because if we really engage with it, we have only one way to go, which is to find a need that was met or not met.